Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
So long as there shall exist, by reason of law and custom, a social condemnation which in the face of civilization artificially creates hells on earth, and complicates a destiny that is divine with human fatality, so long as the three problems of the age, the degradation of man by poverty, the ruin of women by starvation, and the dwarfing of childhood by physical and spiritual night are not solved, books like this cannot be useless. That's the preface to Les Miserables, which we are going to be covering today. Hello and welcome to the Pilgrims Podcast. This is your host, Hannah Long. I'm joined today by...
The patriarch, Alan Long.
And today, we do have a guest for the first few minutes of the show. He's an anonymous Twitter guy. His name is Tacitus, at modern underscore Tacitus. Welcome to the show, Tacitus.
Tacitus.
What do you want to go by?
Joe.
Okay. So, we have our friend Tacitus Joe here today. Who on Twitter really is Tacitus. He runs an anonymous Twitter account from his persona as a Roman citizen, comments on current events. You know, he had several entertaining things to say about the Super Bowl, and I understand he's plotting up some things to say about politics now. But if you're interested in ancient history or politics circa AD 30, then Tacitus is the guy for you. Also, if you're a member of the NRA, you might like him. The reason we're having Tacitus on today is because we're going to be talking about the new Star Wars movie. And Tacitus is a big fan of Star Wars, aren't you, Tacitus?
Yeah.
One of the neat things about these new Star Wars movies is that you really don't know anything about them. They kind of keep all the information secret. But they've been letting out little bits and pieces of information. You know, we found out that Episode 7... is going to be entitled The Force Awakens. We've just discovered that there's a new standalone movie coming out, which is going to be entitled Rogue One. And Tacitus really knows more about Star Wars than either the Progeny or the Patriarch, so I wanted to ask him about some of his speculation about the movie. We don't know too much about it right now. We know that it's directed by, I think, Gareth Edwards. I can't remember if he's directing Episode 7 or that. Anyway, and we do know that one member of the cast has been confirmed, which is a young actress named Felicity Jones, who we were talking about just a few podcasts ago, actually. She's going to be playing a part in it. Anyway, we're having Tacitus on to kind of help us speculate about what's going to go on in that movie. What can the title tell you about it, Tacitus?
Tells you about X-Wing pilot.
Yeah, I believe Rogue One is one of the, in the Star Wars verse, Rogue One would refer to an X-Wing dude.
It's basically a squad of X-Wing pilots.
Yeah, and each one's called, like, Rogue One, Rogue...
Yeah, keep on going.
Yep. So, what would you speculate the story would be about, just kind of from that information?
I guess it's about the bringing up of the rebellion, and, you know,
So you think... So you think it could be a prequel? Kind of
yeah,
like, you
yeah,
know...
Yeah, 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 prequel. The story to the rebellion, I guess.
That could be a pretty interesting story. I mean, Luke had an X-Wing squad, right? And the lead of... I do remember this. I did a little bit of reading up on it. Rogue One probably would have been Wedge Antilles, right?
Yeah.
What do you know about his character?
He's basically a young X-Wing pilot and fly at the first Death Star and second Death Star battles.
Did he survive both of them?
Yeah.
He must have been a pretty hardy fella.
I think he might be on maybe the first two. Episode 4 and 6. And might be on number 3, but...
You mean number 5?
Yeah, number 5.
Yeah, he's like one of the only X-Wing fighters to survive, right? I mean, they're kind of like the Star Trek red shirts. You know that poor old Porky's going to get it.
Yeah, he's played by Dennis Lawson.
Yeah, yeah. Now that was Dennis Lawson. That's actually kind of interesting because if any Anglophiles follow our podcast, which is almost certain, you will have seen him playing Mr. Jarndyce in Bleak House, 2005 Bleak House. It'll be interesting to see if they have him take up the role again in this new thing. Now, if it is a prequel, as you said, then it probably won't be him playing the role because he's much older now. But I kind of think it'll probably be the other way. I think it'll probably be something that takes place later because I think Felicity Jones is in Episode 7, too.
Yeah.
But, okay, so what would be your fantasy Star Wars movie that was led up by a bunch of X-Wing fighters? What would be the best plot ever? You're open to answering this one, too, Patriarch.
The best plot ever?
Yeah, like the
going forward?
Yeah, well, this is an X-Wing movie.
Probably building a time machine, going back and killing Jar Jar Binks.
I think
that would have
so much emotional impact.
Would have a lot of merit, wouldn't it?
Okay. I think this episode is going to be like one of those deals where you see a bunch of people that are laughing at an inside joke and you don't get it, but they're just dying laughing. So maybe our hilarity will be contagious. Let's hope.
Are you looking forward to seeing the return of the old characters, Testus?
Yeah. Instead they're going to be not older.
I mean, it'll be like, hey, Leia, hand me my walker. I got to go do the Kessel Run. I can only do it in about 30 parsecs these days.
Which is your favorite Star Wars movie?
Three. Maybe. I like 3 and 4. Those are probably my
favorite.
Why
do you like them the best?
Yeah, that's because number 4 is the first one. And it's kind of sad during the Empire and stuff. And there's a lot of tension going on.
Yeah, well, there was a lot more tension in that than kind of lots of the political stuff in kind of the earlier movies.
Yeah, that's number 5.
Yeah, Tacitus tends to think that a movie's quality is directly proportional to the amount of fighting that goes into it. Though it's a wonder that he didn't like Man of Steel as much, because that was like the ultimate fight movie. Though he's a big fan of 300, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's all we've got to say about Star Wars. We better.
We didn't say a lot.
Not really. We just giggled a lot. I just wanted to kind of introduce you guys to Tacitus. He's a friend of ours. will you two stop? It's been nice having you on the podcast, Tacitus. If you have any comments while we're talking about Les Mis, you can jump in. I know that you have a particularly good rendition of the confrontation from that. Musical. If we might do an a cappella version of that later with you.
Yeah.
You generally do Javert, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anybody that wants to follow Tacitus can check him out on Twitter. You go ahead and do that. Anyway, we better go ahead and get on to our movie. We're going to be covering Les Miserables from 2012, directed by Tom Hooper today, which we just rewatched over the last few weeks. It's nice to be back. I've been suffering through midterms. I've only just got through with a test today, and I'm finally on to spring break. So that is a relief to be done with all of that. It was there were some days when you found out about a biology test like one day before, and so on and so forth, and it's just rather stressful. Anyway, and it's starting to warm up around here just a little bit. Okay, Les Mis, I did not see Les Mis in the theater. We actually saw it like a year afterwards. I had been meaning to read the book for some time, but I was kind of daunted by it, because on Kindle it's 959 pages, the translation that I ended up getting. So I read the whole thing in 16 days. It was like a marathon. It was pretty amazing. And I knew more about the Parisian sewers and the Battle of Waterloo and the customs of French monasteries than I ever thought I would know or ever wanted to know, really. Old Victor Hugo really didn't know when to say when. That was, but anyway, the to it came out. He was
Russian.
No, he was French.
No.
Think about it.
It's starting well.
Victor Hugoski.
I don't know. I mean, who names their son Victor anymore except the Russians?
The French, apparently. Well, Victor Hugo was, he spent most of his life, for the first few years, he was a devout Catholic. He was in Paris during the June Rebellion, which took place some years after the French Revolution, and that's something we need to get straight right up, because most people think the French Revolution was the last kind of thing of its kind in France. But, in fact, there were several uprisings afterwards. There was, in 1833, which is when this story takes place, or at least part of it, there was the June Rebellion, which was a bunch of students in Paris rising up. I think it was 1848 when you had another one. Even in the late 1800s, I know that the Patriarch read a book that was kind of talked a little bit about some of that, some of the uprisings in Paris. But anyway, this is not the French Revolution. This isn't A Tale of Two Cities. This is taking place much further along. And Victor Hugo was there. He was there during this rebellion. And the neat thing about it is that sometimes in the book he'll just break into first person and say, "So I just happened to be here when Enjolras ran by, and there was Jean Valjean on the other side of the barricade, and I was hiding behind something." You know? But what was really happening was, I think what happened was that he ended up caught between two different barricades, and he hid behind something, and people were just shooting everywhere, and he just stayed there for like a whole day, and then came out once it was all over, and thought, "I ought to write a book about this. I ought to write a book about somebody who didn't hide." So anyway, that was kind of his story. Though he was a Catholic early on in life, and he ended up becoming just a variety of different things, and then by the end of his life he was vehemently anti-Catholic. So it's kind of interesting seeing the variety of religious expressions in the book, because it took him 17 years to write. It was just this huge, huge book. And he also wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which he's also famous for. Now, Les Mis, at the beginning of the 20th century, had pretty much been forgotten. Victor Hugo in general had been forgotten. In 1902, G.K. Chesterton said, "Well, you know, I think that Victor Hugo is going to be remembered sometime this century, because a lot of the things that he wrote about still resonate." And boy, was that true, as whatever Chesterton said tends to be. In the, I believe it was the 80s, early 80s, some French fellows decided to adapt it as a musical, and it wasn't very popular. It wasn't very well received in Paris. But in England, there were some people that heard about it, and they thought, "We ought to adapt that for the English stage." So they came over, and they took the music and rewrote the lyrics in English. And it came over and opened in London to wild, you know, just, it was extremely popular. It initially starred Colm Wilkinson and Roger Allam, who Endeavor fans will recognize. And then, of course, it came over to America, and that was just, it was pretty much no turning back from that point on. The musical is about 2.5 hours long, 3 hours when it's done in its full length. And it manages to condense the book in a pretty good way. It does change certain things, but not too much. It cuts out the entire Battle of Waterloo, which took Hugo about 100 and some pages to cover, and which really didn't have anything to do with the story. It cuts out a lot of those things. Now in 2012, we had the first movie adaptation of the musical. We've had movie adaptations of the book several times before. There was one in the 90s with Liam Neeson and Jeffrey Rush, and there were several others. But this was the first one that was an adaptation of the musical. And it was kind of a labor of love for especially some of the more prominent people involved. Hugh Jackman had been wanting to do it for some time, and he, I would imagine, wanted to kind of get away from Wolverine parts. Kind of the main gimmick in the whole thing was just the the live singing. Everybody talked about the live singing. And that was something that had never really been done in a musical before. It was, I mean, I can't think of any musicals where that was done on, at least, especially on this scale. Usually it was canned. And that usually didn't work out very well. I mean, look at the Phantom of the Opera. That did not turn out very well. What did you think the effect of the live singing was? Did you think it was effective, or what were its strengths and weaknesses for the movie as a whole?
Well, let's back up a bit in that the, because I haven't read the book. And I knew a little bit about the book, or just from you, from your conversations where you'd read it, and what to expect, and I think probably had been tripping around the house singing some of the music, so I was familiar with a little bit of it, but I don't know. I think it worked well. I mean, I do think that this story is, really resonates with people so strongly, and these actors and actresses so strongly, that I think it was a good thing. I mean, I think it was, it added another layer of depth to it, but
Anne Hathaway couldn't have done her thing without the live singing. I mean, that's the crux of the matter, is that, you know, the live singing allowed them to cry if they wanted to pause if they wanted to do all those sorts of things, to act it, you know, instead of just being confined by the music.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, The Sound of Music, I don't think it mattered, you know. It didn't have that same emotional depth as Les Miserables did.
Yeah.
Most things don't, though.
Well, Les Mis is, it's the melodrama to end all melodramas. It's one of those Hamlet-type things where everybody dies at the end. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
But because it's kind of, and I think that it worked at times. This movie is basically one long set of people just acting their heart out. I mean, one after another, after another, after another. Everybody trying to get their moment in the spotlight. And that's a problem. That's kind of a problem because it affects the pacing, and you're just thinking, okay, can somebody just, you know, sing a happy song or just settle down and, you know, have an ordinary conversation instead of trying to impress me with your emotional distraughtness. The best thing about it is that it does allow you to have some of those really wonderful performances in there. Hugh Jackman early on is, I guess we probably ought to go ahead and summarize the movie.
You go for it.
Okay, well, it's about a convict named Jean Valjean who has been in prison for 18 years, right? Or is it 19?
17. I thought it was 7.
I don't
know,
because...
it's not 17, because...
I know it's not 17.
He sings it there at the beginning.
I know. I think it's 18 because...
I think it is, maybe.
Because Dr. Manette was in there for... I don't know. Anyway, we're getting our French prisoners mixed up. Jean Valjean is released on parole after all these years. He had stolen a loaf of bread. We have speculated that it must have been very, very good bread. It would have been something if he'd stolen too.
For his sister's child.
Yes.
It wasn't even for himself.
Yes. He was acting rather nobly, you know. In the book it was 7 children, though. Anyway, he is basically shunned by all of society because he is a convict. And he's eventually taken in by a...
Once
he's paroled, yes. And he's eventually taken in by a priest who gives him food and gives him kindness and who just really treats him like a human being for the first time in, you know, about 20 years. And Valjean repays him by stealing his silver. The priest, when Valjean is caught, which he is that morning, the priest forgives him for stealing his silver, and what's more, gives him the rest of his silver, tells him that, you know, it was never his silver anyway, that it was God's silver, and God wanted him to give it to the poor, and he was poor, so here you go, have a nice life, okay. And so he does. He is kind of converted to Christianity by this act of grace that is shown him by a priest. In the rest of the story, he ends up becoming mayor. It takes about 30 seconds for him to become mayor. We don't know how that happens in the story.
Well, but it says, you know, X years later.
Yes, but still. Anyway, he becomes mayor.
Well, it's almost 3 hours long. It would, you know, they can't make it four or five.
Cut three musical numbers that aren't necessary and then fill in the plot holes. I'm telling you. Okay. Anyway, he becomes mayor, but he has been pursued by somebody who knows him from his former life, and that's Javert.
Because he's broke parole.
Yes. He has broken parole at this point, and nobody knows where he is or who he is, and he's managed to build a life for himself based on his false identity, which is as Monsieur Madeleine. Anyway, he gets pursued by Javert. He would turn himself in. You know, he's thinking, I need to do that because that would be the honest thing to do. But he's got an obligation which he has run into. He saves a prostitute who used to work at one of his factories but was kicked out because of a misunderstanding, and he wasn't able to sort it out. And, you know, anyway, he feels like it's his fault that she ended up turning to prostitution. And her daughter lives outside of town, and she's an orphan now because the prostitute is dead. The prostitute's played by Anne Hathaway, and the character is Fantine. Anyway, Valjean needs to get her daughter, so he goes and gets her daughter, Cosette, and decides that she needs somebody to raise her, so he continues to be on the run. And that's the second half of the movie, is basically him trying to escape Javert, while simultaneously there are a bunch of guys trying to start a revolution in Paris, one of whom falls in love with Cosette when she grows up, and then there's a big barricade sequence, and Valjean and Javert meet up again after the barricade. And at this point, Valjean has saved Javert's life, and Javert can't handle it. He doesn't understand why in the world Valjean would do this, why he would forgive him, why he would extend grace to him. So because of that, he decides to let Valjean go, but he can't handle that either because, like, his entire identity is crumbling. So he takes a flying leap off a bridge. And that's pretty much the end. So, that's the story, if you could follow that at all, if you haven't seen it.
That's not completely the end, but
that's basically
part
the
of
end.
The end.
That was where...
That's one ending.
That's where the Liam Neeson movie ended. Which,
oh, really?
Yeah, they skipped the rest of it, which actually worked pretty well. Anyway, so that is the story. I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of some of the technical aspects before we get into the story itself. I wanted to talk about the editing and this director's use of close-ups, which a lot of people kind of complained about. They said, well, it was a little bit distracting. And I can kind of understand it, because I think a problem with this movie and a problem with most productions of Les Mis is that they can't capture just the scale of it. They can't capture the scale of the revolution in Paris. And that's one of the things that Victor Hugo was really good at. In the book, he would take the point of view and put it all over Paris while this was going on. He says, so meanwhile, you know, over in on the other end of Paris, there were people going about their business, people going to work, people, you know, and just it was perfectly peaceful. And then you look over there across the river and things, and you can hear guns shooting a few streets over, but other people are just, you know, moving on with their lives. So it's and that was interesting, because you kind of got a sense of the scope of the thing. And of course he would go to the Battle of Waterloo and follow around armies. He would do all sorts of different things, and it really gave it a sense of scale, which this movie does not have. This movie does not have a sense of scale. The opening shot is promising on that count. You have this enormous shot of a ship being dragged into a
dry dock.
Into a dry dock by convicts, and it's a huge shot. It's really remarkable, and that gives you the sense of the kind of the epicness of it all. But there aren't many of those shots in this movie, because it's so focused on being intimate with each of the characters, on giving them their emotional moment, that it really doesn't have a sense of kind of the bigger size, which I think is unfortunate. And that's also a reason why the live singing was a little bit of a problem, was because it was more difficult to do the big shots if you were going to have live singing, and getting everything together, getting all the actors working in sync, that sort of thing. What did you think about the editing, or just the?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen it on the big screen, so I don't know. You know, I guess it is unusual, but again, to me, this is an unusual movie, an unusual story, and so I'm willing to, in this case, I think willing to grant more liberty for that kind of stuff, because again, he's trying to get the emotion out of it, and I guess, for lack of a better word, the power out of these songs and the story. And, you know, I mean, you watch that Anne Hathaway song, her, you know, premiere song on it, and it's just about as good as it can get. I mean, if it had been... Okay, ask yourself this. If it had been shot 20 feet away with her, it would have been good, but I don't know if it would have been great, and it's great.
Well, that's not a problem. I mean, that scene needed to be intimate because of the content, but if you're doing a song where all of these guys are getting together to do a revolution, don't do it indoors. Don't have a bunch of guys in a bar somewhere doing this. Get them outdoors. Get them on the rooftops.
Yeah, but that's setting it up later for, you know, empty chairs and empty tables.
Well, yeah, but you know, and that musical number felt a little bit superfluous too. Eddie Redmayne was really good in that scene, but I was thinking, okay, I'm not, you know, this, do we really need another big breaking down musical number right here? Where, you know, this movie is starting to feel too long. There were a few things
the movie almost needed an intermission. I mean, it's one of those things where you I don't know. I mean, I think that the folks that are gonna like that movie the most are the people who are the fans. Who want to see that, and they expected to see that. I mean, the people that really, really like this movie, I think, are the fans and the people that appreciate it for what it's trying to do. And to them, which I think I'm one of now, I wonder what that makes me.
A fan?
I'm a Swiftie.
Well, let's not go over that territory again.
That you don't mind it. I mean, you know, that it's part of the story. I mean, you're thinking about it from a marketing standpoint, and you're right.
Well,
you know, from a marketing standpoint for broad audiences. Yeah.
No, I don't mean that. I mean that I'm looking at it from a quality standpoint. I'm saying this movie could have been better. I mean, because
cutting out that song.
Yeah. Now listen, people would have hated it.
Right.
I know. But it would have made it a better movie. Cutting some of it, or at least, you know, this movie either should have been shorter or longer.
Yeah.
Because you needed breaks between songs to sit down and think about these things that they're singing at. Instead, they're just throwing everything at you.
That's somewhat true, but...
Now, Tom Hooper, it would have been a courageous, artistic decision to cut some stuff. To say, okay, you know, we just can't do this. You know, I think to cut Cazette's little musical number, maybe, trim that, and then... do different things, you know. So I just think that it would have made it a better movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that those decisions would not have been effective from a marketing standpoint, because this movie made tons of money. Tons. I'm just saying it would have made it a better movie. And also, it is difficult to translate a musical to the screen, especially a musical like this one, because you end up with plot holes. You end up thinking, oh, well, why did that happen? Why can't...
Well, again, I mean, you know, for the it wasn't made, I don't think, for the 17 to 20 year old male. You know, I mean, they don't have that kind of, it's just not for them. I mean, it's,
well,
you know, and yeah, I mean,
17 to 20 year old males love movies with plot holes. I'm saying, I'm trying to look at them.
They don't like lots of singing.
Yeah, but.
But. I mean, you're right about it jumping kind of from song to song, but that's what it is. I mean, that is what it is.
But it's not what it has to be.
But it is what it has to be.
In other words, you're saying that this movie could not have been improved.
Well, what are you going to put between what are you going to put between those?
Well, there's a 959 page book that has a few suggestions. You have a few scenes with Valjean and Cosette growing up. You know, kind of get a little bit more insight into her character. She's always been.
I don't know how you do
you
that.
You write a scene with conversations in it.
But they're singing it.
They don't have to sing it.
Yeah, they do have
no,
to
they
sing
don't
it.
Have to
they
sing
have
it.
They have to sing it.
There are conversations in this movie that do not involve singing. It is possible.
It's like an opera.
It's not an opera, though.
But it's like there are things you can't mess with. There's simply things you can't mess with.
Even if it would make it better?
No, it wouldn't have made it better.
But it would make it better.
It would not have made it better.
Well, listen, I watched this movie with some people who were not familiar with the movie at all. And so I got to the end of it, and I talked to them, you know, and one of the guys was like, well, why in the world didn't Valjean tell Cosette that he was a convict? Why didn't he explain that to her? And why didn't he tell Marius that he saved him? Why didn't he do that? Why didn't he do this? Why didn't he do that? You know, and I knew immediately why that was, because it's in the book.
But there's too much. There's too many of, too much of that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just, there's too much. Why did he steal the lump of, you know, the loaf of bread?
Well, you don't need that information.
Why did he become mayor? Why did he,
well,
you know,
yeah,
I mean,
you don't necessarily need that information. Give it two or three sentences of exposition. And that would deal with it. But some things do need to be developed to kind of give you a more fully rounded story. It would be rather important to know why Valjean didn't decide to tell Marius he saved him, because that totally doesn't make any sense in the context of this movie that you were making. It doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't he tell him? Now, in the book, it explains that. I can't remember exactly what it is, but Valjean has some sort of explanation for it. Give him a chance to say that. Give him, you know, 2 minutes to explain that, and the ending will flow much more easily. It will be much more emotionally resonant. I like to have movies that make sense. Okay.
But moving on.
Okay. Now that we've fought our battle over that one. Okay, the movie is split into roughly two parts. The first focuses on the story of Valjean, with Fantine's story as a major subplot. The second takes Marius as its point of view, and Marius is a young revolutionary and uses him as a medium through which we explore the world of the June Rebellion. The first half establishes two themes, religious faith and societal problems. Both Valjean and Fantine's story arcs incorporate these themes, showing an individual sinking into depravity due to the ills of society. Valjean, because he could not support his sister's family, Fantine, because she could not support her daughter. And those things are kind of given a resolution by the effects of religious faith, which is very unusual in a Hollywood movie, but it's, again, it's kind of one of those things you can't cut because it's right there in the musical. Belief is something that's really important in this movie. There are different types of belief, and that was something that was very important to Victor Hugo in general. The second half of the movie moves the focus away from Valjean's story to the revolution. And that's a bunch of kids, basically, who decide that they want to fight for liberty. From the depiction of the revolution in the film, what would you conclude the motivations of the revolutionaries were? What did they want to accomplish?
They wanted Obamacare. They wanted socialized medicine. um What did they want? They wanted a better world, and they wanted to hear the people sing. And they wanted to, you know, like most young idealists, they wanted this ideal world where things just magically happen. But, I guess.
Well, like I suspected, this,
oh, no.
This movie doesn't do a very good job of showing you what they really wanted.
They're like every other young revolutionary.
Well, no, they're not like every young revolutionary, because Occupy Wall Street was a bunch of kids my age deciding to sit around and complain about things. These kids put their lives on the line because they wanted liberty. They wanted a different form of government. And in this...
Yeah.
And in this movie, you don't really get much of a sense of the kind of their political aims. It's much more... And this is true of the musical, too. It's much more focused on kind of societal problems and saying, okay, well, the rich are the problem. The rich are the problem. We need to take care of the rich. We need to cut the fat ones down to size, you know. And instead of talking about a little bit more strictly about some of their beliefs, because these were kids that read Greek philosophers, you know, this wasn't just some sort of nebulous idea. I would have liked to have seen a little
bit
more of that.
But it's the same as the French Revolution, is it not?
American Revolution.
No, the French Revolution. Isn't that what they wanted? Isn't that what they wanted?
What did they want?
The same as the French Revolution, quote unquote liberty, right? Which was anything but. I mean, in other words. I mean, they're revolutionaries. I mean, that's all I needed to know. I didn't need to know what kind of judicial system they were going to set up.
The political resonance of this movie is important. This was the year that Occupy Wall Street was going on. Everybody was saying this is totally talking about Occupy Wall Street, and the kid is, you know, that climbs into the rich people's carriage and is talking about all that. It's a very vengeful type of revolution, and in the book that was not as much the way that it was. And it was true that they wanted to, you know, cut down the ones who were oppressing the people, but they had a sense of justice. They weren't just vigilantes, and they just weren't.
Welcome to the, you know, what year was this supposed to be?
1833.
Welcome to the 1833s. I mean, what did you say?
1833. This was the 1833s. I think it's important to represent what they did believe in, and they didn't.
Why? Not for the movie it is. You were just talking about pacing. Do you want to get into, you know, what their philosophies were?
The movie frames the songs in a way in which, and I think the musical does this as well, is to make it seem as if it's kind of more of a class warfare thing. And it was partly, but not entirely. Not at all entirely.
I just don't understand
anyway,
why that's really important to the story.
Well, I think
they were revolutionaries. It was a subplot.
But it wasn't. In the book, this was the main plot.
But this isn't the book. This is a musical based on the book.
Yes, and it is a bad adaptation.
But if you want a good
I'm trying to explain
that. If you want
that.
A good adaptation, it's going to be a lot longer. I mean, I didn't like the boys up in the... I didn't like those guys.
You see, my dad has an instinctive distrust of anybody that looks like they could have ever been in a boy band.
I could have been in a boy band.
Yeah, I've seen your high school pictures.
Yep.
It would have been the lamest boy band ever.
No, that's not true.
It is totally true. Mama's over there laughing.
The matriarch is not laughing. She's not laughing.
She's totally laughing. The matriarch is laughing. Okay, well... Here was the thing. In the book, there were two different types of belief that the first one was religious faith, and that was Valjean, and the other one was faith in representative government, and those ideals. And that was a really big deal. That was a really big, important part of the story. And the entire second half of this movie is dominated by those revolutionaries. Which I think is a mistake. you can go two ways. Like, the first half of this movie, I think, is the strongest part of the movie. It's much more interesting. It's got a protagonist that you care about. It's kind of smaller in scale. And then you get to the second half of the movie, and suddenly, pretty much three-quarters of the story is about these revolutionaries that you've never met before, that you don't know much about, who apparently are mad at rich people, and that you should care about because they are mad at rich people. And we don't even know the rich people either. I mean, the rich people just kind of sit there and, you know, I don't think it does a very good job of telling you who the enemy is or of telling you who the good guys are. You know, do it one way or the other. So if you're going to do that, then let us know a little bit about what these guys believe, what they're like, instead of just introducing them all in mass. Either do that or focus more on Valjean. Now, ideally, I would have liked the story to focus more on Valjean anyway, because I think that you lose the emotional connection with him and all the stuff going on in the barricade, and then suddenly, you know, the movie isn't about him anymore, and that's kind of a problem.
Do I get to say anything now?
Yes, you can say something.
You're wrong.
Okay.
Well, no. I mean,
and always
it,
have been wrong.
Are
you going to sing to me?
I might... the song. Well, I mean, that's somewhat true, but I don't know, it's just part of the backdrop. I mean, I don't really care about Marius and Cosette so much. I mean,
because they're underdeveloped.
There you go again.
I will be quiet.
I just didn't think there's time to do all of that. I mean, you cannot, it's too big of a story. Now, I think that there is somewhat of a...
We'll cut things.
Somewhat of a disconnect with the revolutionaries, because they just seem like a bunch of jerks, quite frankly. But that would resonate with a lot of people. A lot of people would like that. I'm not one of them, but a lot of people would like what they have to say and what they're singing about. And what they're trying to... But I'm not particularly one of them. I just wanted them to, you know,
die.
I recognized them for what they were, which was, I knew that they were all, well, I kind of knew how it ended.
Look, how long does it take to do Insight? It just takes one scene to kind of give you a little bit of backstory on characters.
Moving on.
Okay. Well, let's go back to Javert and Valjean, because that's the only thing you like about this movie.
I love that book, but this movie.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
And obviously, you wouldn't want to cut any of the revolutionary parts, even though you say you hate them, because you're such a purist.
I am a purist.
Okay. Why did Javert let Valjean go?
Because Grace had finally got through to him, I guess. Or that he saw that Grace trumped the law.
So?
That doesn't mean that he accepted it. But he finally saw that was the fact, that mercy was more important than justice.
And why was that suddenly important to him? Was it because...
Because he'd seen it played out his entire life chasing this guy, and he kept, you know, there in that little song there where they're having that confrontation. He says something along those lines, you know, the man of mercy again, you know, or something, calls him like that. And I think he's just saying that, oh, great, you know, now you're, you know, doing some other act of benevolence to someone that doesn't know or care, and you think that that's going to make a difference, and it finally did make a difference to him. You know, finally did make a difference. And quite frankly, he had let him go earlier, unconditionally, to where, you know, he had basically said, if you let me go, I will come back and I will find you and I will kill you, or bring you to justice, which is the same thing, in Javert's mind. But by the time he gets to the sewer, it's just been working on him.
So why does he commit suicide?
Because he can't, because that's not... a system that he thinks that he can live with. He has a hard heart.
Right? He's somebody who, I think...
It's tragic. It's just tragic.
Now, in the book, he was not a religious person. He was somebody who had just kind of this blind respect for authority. And basically, one of the big points of the book was about ceasing to have blind respect for authority. That was why the revolution paralleled Valjean's story, is that they both didn't just... Valjean didn't just respect the law. He realized when mercy had to trump the law. The revolutionaries believed that there was a law greater than just brute force and government, you know, that sort of thing. And Javert couldn't cope with the idea that his entire life had been built on a structure which was faulty.
Yeah.
I mean, he recognized that the only reason he was still alive was grace, but he hated that. He hated the fact that he was wrong. He hated the fact that this world, you know, wasn't like he had thought it was. And he just couldn't deal with that. And it's a really interesting parallel, because of course when Valjean encounters grace, he has a completely different reaction. He too comes to realize that his way of looking at the world is completely wrong, but but he ultimately ends up surrendering. And another neat aspect to it is that they are singing the exact same song.
And it, yeah.
At the time.
And that's exactly right.
Which is a nice parallel.
Yes, it's a great parallel, because they both have that moment of truth. They both have that moment of truth that they have to.
Yeah.
But they have to decide which way they're going to go. And Valjean says, you know, I'm willing to give it a, you know, I can live with that.
And I think part of it is that the fact that he comes from a place of humility. He's a sinner, and Javert is a Pharisee. Of course, he's reinvented as a Pharisee in the musical. That was not in the book. But it works very well because it's a very similar type of way of looking at the world, is just that absolutist and totalitarian way of thinking. And they just can't deal with the idea that the law might not be sufficient. So, this is definitely kind of a downer of a story. Even from the it's a movie where lots and lots of people die, and it's I mean, just the title is Les Misérables. So, why is it that you think it's so popular when there's so much death, so much destruction in the story?
I don't know. I think it's only popular with a certain...
I mean, because it's got a very, very, very wide audience. It's the longest-running Broadway musical in the world.
Yes. But I don't... I mean, I guess my inclination is that it is only popular with a certain type of person.
Okay.
I'm going to maybe go out on a limb here, but is that kind of my Calvinist underpinnings here, is that there are certain people whom this story touches. There are many people, I think, that if you step back and if you presented this story in a completely different way, okay, this man stole, he broke his parole, the police officer, who was very honorable, you know, tracks him down, where he continues to run from the police. You can almost present this story in a pro-Javert way, and it would resonate with a lot of other people.
Yeah, but people don't like police officers that mistreat poor prostitutes that sing romantic songs.
I know, that's right. And I'll admit that, you know, I mean, if you push me, you know, I would say, well, yeah, you know, Javert. Or the bigger question is, you know, Jean Valjean, he's broke the law. You know, the law of the land, and he did not, you know, should he have? You know,
but people as a whole don't have much of a problem with that. When you steal a loaf of bread to support somebody else, I mean...
I know that, but I'm saying is that you could have I think the movie resonates with a certain type of person. And the overlying story, they recognize grace when they see it. They recognize mercy when they see it. And that's something very powerful. And this particular story presents that beautifully. You know.
I think that there are people who come to the story looking for that, but there are lots of other people that come to it because of other things, just the music, the spectacle of the thing.
No, I don't
well,
think so.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know atheists that like this movie.
That's why I'm a Calvinist.
A lot of it is that a lot of people find the whole subplot with the revolutionaries very interesting. The other people that I watched it with were much more interested in that than Valjean.
Well, they're not right.
Well, they're not you and me, okay? We are... let me finish. We are kind of instinctively... We're going to like Valjean because that's something that interests me and you. But a lot of people find other parts of the story more interesting. The love triangle.
Oh,
with,
give me a break.
Listen, I've been on Tumblr for about a month now. You would not believe the amount of people that are obsessed with the story of Marius, Cosette, Eponine, and the Barricade Boys.
It's all there's not many. It's a passing thing. The heart of this, I mean, going back to that video, the older couple, maybe I say older, maybe my age, and they were in the cab with their son. Then they just come out of the movie and they were bawling, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
Yes, I have.
And he's laughing at them and videotaping them and asking them questions while they're crying and stuff. And that's the heart of this story. You know, the people that are spun up on it now on Tumblr over that won't be 2 years from now. They will not be. But there's another group of people who recognize that deeper story and that deeper beauty of it, and they'll be there 20 years from now.
I think people like a good tragedy, too. I mean, they like the drama of it.
I will give you a little bit on that one, but not much. It's not anywhere like Sound of Music. That's, you know, Sound of Music, that kind of drama. This is a story about redemption.
Yeah, but like the entire second half of the movie.
And there are people that, and that's what people want. They may not know it, like you said a moment ago. They might not even know it, but that resonates deeply with people, even when they don't know it.
That's true, and I do think that a lot of it comes down to that. So
the rest is fluff. I mean, the other, you know, the revolution and the love story and all that stuff is just kind of like. To fill in the gaps, you know, it kind of, I don't know. It's a great movie. I mean, it's just you didn't talk about the Thénardiers.
Thénardiers. I'm not a huge fan of the Thénardiers in this production, though I understand I may be in the minority on that. I'm just not a huge fan of Sacha Baron Cohen and Helena Bonham Carter here.
Yeah, me neither.
They just feel out of step with the rest of the story.
It feels like Disney, or not Disney. It feels like, what does it feel like? It feels like
a nightmarish version of Disney.
Tim Burton.
Yeah,
it's like Tim Burton snuck in and shot a couple songs.
Yeah, I've noticed something else too. With just kind of period dramas recently, and I think this started with the Pride and Prejudice version in 2005, is that they've kind of lost a lot of respect for period costumes. Like the lovely lady scene, yeah, and the Thénardier scene, those felt too gaudy for that time period.
It felt too...
This movie in general kind of feels a little bit too colorful, a little bit... It doesn't have much of a sense of historical place.
There are the Thénardiers that didn't work well in my opinion, from the costumes and the sets. That didn't work well, in my opinion.
And I mean, it was probably needed because it was a nice change from all of the everybody just having an emotional meltdown all the time.
I mean, I guess.
But I think it's much better handled in other versions of the musical.
Which one?
I really liked, my favorite version of all time is the 1995 reunion cast, which was Colm Wilkinson and Philip Quast and a bunch of other people. And Alan Armstrong plays Thénardier, and he's just a hoot. He's a lot of fun. That would have been a big, fun musical number. This one just feels so, I don't know.
Scripted. It didn't fit well. Or, you know, it felt just...
Yeah, it didn't really have much just impulsiveness or... Yeah, it didn't flow very nicely.
But I'm thinking about when she, Anne Hathaway, singing in the factory. You know, all the girls are dressed the same way, and their hands are all moving the same way as they work on the tables. And I mean, it's very theatrical. The whole thing is very theatrical. You mentioned the other day that they were. What was the word you used? I asked if it was like the musical, and you said ridiculously slow.
Slavishly.
Slavishly slow, that's it. And maybe they did, maybe there was a little bit of that, but...
I've seen alternative takes. I've watched two other Les Mis movies. I've seen the one with Liam Neeson. I've seen the one, I've seen another one. I've seen a part of one that's in French that stars John Malkovich.
Non-musical types.
Yes. John Malkovich as Javert, believe it or not. Hey, Valjean, you want a candy bar? So, yeah. Yeah, you stole a loaf of bread, didn't you, kid?
No.
People do anything for a loaf of bread.
But it's a wonderful movie. When Miss Hathaway sings that song, they ought to just stop the cameras and brought the Grammy over and gave it to her.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it's. That was.
Wow.
There were two or three really good. I really liked, from a musical standpoint, I think that Jackman's performance during Valjean's soliloquy is his high point in the movie. Period.
When he's in the with the priest is giving him the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's his high point in the movie.
I agree.
Anne Hathaway, obviously, you know, she's great. Though I wish they could have stretched out her storyline just a little bit, just so it didn't seem like it all happened in one afternoon. And I think that Samantha Barks is really good as Eponine in her big musical number.
Agreed.
She doesn't overdo it. She keeps with the music. She thinks she's in a musical, and she's the only actor in this movie that thinks they're in a musical. Everybody else is trying to act their way out of the movie.
I hope she didn't, like, catch pneumonia.
Yeah, I was a little worried. I thought that the fellow that played Enjolras did a very good job. He brought some real conviction to it, unlike a bunch of all the other kind of young guys.
Agreed.
I thought he was very good.
You could see him going out and killing some French soldiers.
I wasn't a huge fan of the kid Gavroche. I thought that he was just too nasty for the role. He seemed, and again, the kind of the sentiment of anti-rich thing, he really, you know, I don't think he was a good spokesperson for the revolution, because the instant he comes on screen, he's the one who's supposed to explain this to you, and so I wasn't buying it from that instant onward, because I didn't like him. I think that if somebody like Enjolras had done it, then I might have been more interested in the revolutionaries. I thought Eddie Redmayne did a pretty good job, actually, as Marius. I thought his big empty chairs at empty tables, he was very good in that scene. Though, again, I thought the scene kind of felt superfluous. Amanda Seyfried, she was okay as Cosette, but that was kind of a part that has always been underwritten and doesn't get much space. Hugh Jackman's other big moment was when he sang Suddenly, which was a song that was written for this movie. He was really good in that because that was written for him. So the rest of the time, his lowest point definitely would be Bring Him Home. I mean, it is epically bad.
It is not epically bad.
Oh, it's epically bad.
It is not epically bad.
It's epically bad.
It's epically bad compared to your guy.
Exactly.
Compared to me doing it, it's epically good.
Are you in any danger of being in any movie for anything?
Actually, you know.
Okay.
Once this podcast gets out, we may make the movie version of the Pilgrims podcast.
Well, I'm not in any danger of being in any movie either.
What would our songs be? The Pilgrims podcast. The song, Why Do We Talk About Star Wars?
With people who don't know what they're talking about.
The matriarchs.
We put her to sleep.
We'll have to have one of the matriarch coming in and lending her 2 cents every once in a while. We have a little tune on that.
Anyway, Hugh Jackman, it would have been a much better song if they'd lowered it so that he could sing it without, you know, looking like he was about to burst an artery or something. Maybe we could just sing the last bit of our podcast.
Epically bad.
What are we going to do next week?
I don't know. Let's see. What shall we do next week? What?
We could do Jurassic Park, which we just watched. Maybe we'll just talk about Starbucks. We think that this talking politics in Starbucks idea is great, and we endorse it. And we're going to stand against the conservative establishment. We're going to start a revolution from our coffee shop.
I've never been inside. I've never set foot in a Starbucks. Actually, I guess maybe I did.
I never go to Starbucks anyway. They really support,
with someone else.
They support Planned Parenthood, I think. So I just
I
got them anyway.
I think it's rather a loathsome little shop, but you know, I think it's not a bad idea. I might go in there and
It's freedom of speech at work.
Hot chocolate and tell them exactly what I think, which I'm sure they'll be delighted to hear.
And yeah, it'll if conservatives would support something like that, then it would make them seem much less like old fogies. We were just saying this. I mean, because it's just like, well, you know, I just want to go in there and get a coffee, and I don't want to hear any young person's idea about something. Well, look, you know, if this young person is a young liberal, then engage them. Talk about it. Engage people, conservatives. You can do it.
Look how I got crying.
Exactly.
Maybe that's not a good example.
Okay. You want to talk about Jurassic Park? We could watch all three of those movies and talk about them. Well, we can talk. Watch the first and the third one.
They're not. Are they worth an hour talking about?
We can talk about Spielberg in general.
Okay.
I don't know.
I guess so. We'll talk about Mr. Spielberg.
Okay, well, next week we're talking Mr. Spielberg. In the meantime, you can find us all over the internet. You can find us at longview95.blogspot.com. That's the Pilgrims Podcast blog. I blog at Longish. The Patriarch blogs at What's He That Wishes So. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. And if you have any comments on this episode, want to tell the Patriarch that he's wrong about anything he said today, or if I'm wrong about anything, you can email us at thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. In the meantime, have a good week, and remember that to love another person is to see
the
face of
God.
To love another person is to see the face of God.